welcome to this early evening talk. Hello to the audience that sits here. Hello also to the audience that sits behind their screens at home, maybe, or at listening to Radio Helsinki. My name is Sheila Streika. I'm one of the curators of Elevate. With me on stage is our special guest this year, and I'm very honored to introduce her to you, Suzanne Jani. Please, a warm welcome. So Suzanne, thanks much for being here with us and also agreeing to this artist talk. Before we have the pleasure of experiencing one of your live shows at Dom im Berg. I'd like to take the chance to talk to you, as it's rare to have like an icon of electronic music sitting next to me. It's really, I'm quite nervous. So maybe let me first introduce you. Like, I tried to keep it as compact as possible, but just that everyone is like on the same page. So Suzanne, you're a five times Grammy nominated composer. You're a pioneer of electronic music, a musician, a pianist, an improviser, a sound designer, the first female synth hero, like The Guardian, for example, termed it. Suzanne ranges as one of the most sophisticated analog modular synth performers worldwide. She's born in 1946 in Indiana, close to Boston, so on the East Coast. She wanted to become ballerina before starting to play the piano as a child, a passion that never stopped. So an autodidact, more or less. I think you had just 1 year of classes or something. With a love for Chopin, she started studying music and composition, so she's trained as a traditional composer. Upon graduation, she went to the University of California at Berkeley to continue her studies in composition, and she received her master's degree there in 1968. But more importantly, maybe, she came in touch with the San Francisco Tape Music Center that was founded by Morton Subotnick, and also like Pauline Oliveros was working there. And in this same year, she was introduced also to Don Buchla. So, like, a very, a meeting that's very, that was very important in your life. So you fell in love with this instrument, the analog modular synth, like the Buchla box, the Buchla. And it was quite unconventional, not only that, like, to be a female composer, but also to get into electronic music was completely, like, out of, like, I can imagine, like, how special it was. So 1974, finally, she moved to New York City to begin a career as a sound designer. Like, being in love with these sounds, like the electronic sounds. She started her own production company, Jani Musica, creating iconic commercials as the Pop and Poor sound for Coca-Cola. She worked for Pepsi, General Electric, Atari, Xenon. So it was a lot about, like, designing sounds for these commercials. She became a devotee for synthesizers for the next two decades. She worked, for example, also for Yamaha and Roland, so not only Buchla. Then in 1982, Seven Waves, her first studio album was released, kind of like it was filed under New Age, though I would rather file it under Kosmischer or something like close to that. A few years later, The Velocity of Love came out, which is more and more like you were leaning towards acoustical instruments and then eventually also returning to the piano. So it was 2016 that the underground label Finders Keepers rediscovered her early recordings and released like a recording from live footage from a concert in New York City, like 1975 it was. So around that time, like in the 2010s, there was this really renaissance of interest in the analog modular synth. So it was the time when you got rediscovered. And it was, maybe we can, yeah, maybe I can stop here because we are here now, like, and the fascination for the modular synth is still ongoing. I would like to first maybe jump back to the late 60s, early 70s, because I'm like, I mean, 68, you graduated in 68. It was such an important year. Like, there was so much going on in the States, but also in Europe. Like, it was really counter culture happening, like countercultural movements coming together. And I'm like, this huge cultural shift that happened towards liberation, emancipation, like freedom, equality, these revolutionary times when students would go on the streets and rally. I'm wondering how this social political climate inspired you as an artist, like your cultural production as well, if you would define yourself as countercultural in a way.
Well, in those days, I mean, I arrived in Berkeley in 1968, and I had come from a women's college near Boston. So we had tea at 4 o'clock. It was very polite and serious. And I get to Berkeley. The reason I went there was that they paid me to go. And otherwise, I would have gone to Paris to study with Nadia Boulanger, where all the modern composers studied with Nadia Boulanger. But I wanted to be independent, and so I went to California. I didn't even know what was there. One day, I'm sitting in the music room playing Chopin, and a rock comes through the window. And I look out of the window and I see hundreds of people demonstrating, and the police, you know, with clubs and tear gas. It was a very dramatic time. So you couldn't help but be politicized. And that was part of the shift. Whether that political shift, I think it impacts everything because it was all about freedom. It was about protest. It was about not allowing, you know, forces to tell you what to do. And I think that was very much a part of Buchla's mentality as well, and the whole area. I mean, California was just a, I don't know what the English word is. I don't know the German word either. But it was a very fertile, creative place. A lot of music was coming out of California then. The Mamas and the Papas, the Jefferson Airplane, everybody was crazy, you know. So anyway, I let my hair grow down to my waist. I didn't wear shoes for 2 years. I got arrested. All these things were just part of that time.
You got arrested for what?
They actually thought that I was, there was this group called the Weathermen who put bombs in banks. And I'm a pacifist. I mean, I don't like violence. I can't watch it any place. I have no, you know, capacity to have violence in my life. But when these investigators came to my home in Berkeley and they saw my studio with all the electronics, I was an obvious candidate for bomb making. And so I was so scared. They arrested me and I had to go to court. And I thought, me? You know, this is absurd. And so it was a very, very nervous time. And fortunately, I didn't have to go to prison. But it made you realize how really fragile all of your freedom is.
But I mean, as a composer or someone who studied composition at that time, I mean, there was also lots of things going on, like composition-wise, because I mean, in the 60s, you would stop, like, also being based in the States, like, you would stop being too influenced maybe by Western classical music, because this, like, dictated all the, like, decades before and centuries how music should sound like. And then in America, with early minimalism happening, and all these people that also kind of were your surrounding, or I imagine, like, the ideas would circulate in these universities. I mean, how influenced are you by early minimalism, for example? Like,
that came later. Mm-hmm. At this time, when I was in university, what I noticed was that it seemed to be disconnected from anything that seemed natural to me. It was all about operations and, you know, 12-tone, not minimalism, but using, you know, there were a lot of compositional frameworks, but it wasn't coming from emotion. You know, for me, music was about expression, about even melody, you know, maybe because I was Italian and I grew up on opera. But more than that, it was that it just, you know, academic music took a wrong turn. It got divorced from any kind of emotion. It got complicated. People were showing off by being complex. And the thing about electronic music is that it negated complexity. Because complexity was easy. It wasn't a challenge. I could play faster than in Paderewski. I could play, you know, I could do anything. It was magical. And so all that firewall of, you know, that you had to achieve being a challenging composer was meaningless. And also, you know, the other side of it is that, I mean, this is an old story, but the system was not encouraging. There were no women composers then that you could listen to that were in your kind of examples, role models. There weren't any. And my professors were, you know, I had an Italian conductor, and he told me, out. Coley said, you know, women have no right on the podium. Now, this was devastating to me to hear. And then a composition teacher saying, what's wrong with women? Can't they write long pieces? And, you know, in my mind, a long piece and a short piece are exactly the same. There was an analysis form back then, you know, where you reduce a long work to its most succinct architecture. I even forget what it's called because I forget everything now, but it's not, you know, a value judgment whether something is long or short. When I went to New York, my compositions, some of them were a third of a second. I did a sound for the telephone company. It was a third of a second. To me, it had a beginning, a middle, and an end. I loved working in the microcosm of sound. You know, these, you could go in there with a scalpel and, yeah.
I'm also wondering how this, like, working in this microcosm also, like, influences the way you are listening. Like, which modes of listening, or which mode of listening did you, are you kind of using kind of when listening to piano music, but also like what kind of listening is active when you're listening or finding these new electronic sounds, like the curiosity also that arises, I can imagine, from this new cosmos kind of.
Yeah, as an electronic, it's as in sound design, you listen, you take everything apart. So when you hear a sound, you're hearing all the elements of the sound. You think about everything separate and how it all comes together to make one sound. So you're analyzing it at the same time, And so you can take it apart and go in and do things to it and come out with a new sound, you know? But you do listen in a very, it's a different way from listening to classical music.
Is it maybe also different because it's, like I read that you wanted to make commercial sounds more sensual and more sexy maybe also. So I was wondering like how this is achieved and which sounds would fit this description better than others. Like how, or is it just a relation that you have to the sounds that you can intuitively tell which ones would fit well this?
Well, there are so many elements to that feminine. I think of it as a feminine side. And my first album, Seven Waves, you know, was completely electronic. But one of my approaches had to do with tempo. So I took a normal tempo, say something you played on the piano, and I would slow it down at least in half. The beauty of the machines is that they could play very slowly and rhythmically, and people couldn't do that very well. And I thought that that subliminal security of knowing that there was a slow tempo that would never miss, would never let you down. It was the machine giving you comfort. And that was how Seven Waves came into being. I thought it was a safe place to be, a nurturing place. And that's what I wanted to create.
And I mean, this fascination for the boucle, maybe we can jump to that moment in time where you entered this studio and you heard these sounds. I'm really curious, like, why you wouldn't, like, why the fascination arose, because it's not like you could have easily said, oh, that's noises or whatever, but it was like musical material to you, like, and you were interested in it as a composer. Maybe you can describe what this fascination also for you being a composer, finding this instrument with these new sounds, like, how this all came together and how it felt, or...
There's another factor here, and that is that in the summer of 1969, I studied at Stanford University at the Artificial Intelligence Lab, and Max Matthews, you know, those of you in music work with Max, Max Matthews was the father of computer music. And I studied with him for a whole summer. And you know, if you use Max, I mean, you take apart the sound. You start with a wave, then you go to an amplitude, and then you go to a combining waveforms. And so you assemble a sound, you think of it in terms of its elements, all those elements. And that was part of me too, because then when I met the boucle, I was already hearing like that. I was always already taking apart sounds and controlling them. You know, you could make it do what you wanted. And for me, it was poetry. My very first album that I never credited as being an album because it was just a limited edition, it was called Voices of Packaged Souls. Do you know that one? Yeah. So that was the sound of heat, the sound of an old man loving, the sound of a flower falling, the sound of cold, the sound of... And it was seemed so natural to interpret these ideas in sound. It was a poetry. And so for me, everything had an implicit sound. So if you look at a glass of water and you say, well, what sound is... the glass of water, there is a sound. It doesn't need to make a sound, but there is a sound that is the sound of water or a glass of water. So, you know, that was just a natural, I don't know where that came from, but yeah.
I think this talent also to translate is one quality that made you such a great sound designer, possibly? Like, I mean, I was also wondering, like, in commercials, would you look for, like, the sounds of an image? Like, how would, for example, this pop and poor sound, like, you would try until you find it, or you already know how to get it? And then, like, how important is the experiment in all this, like, to experiment to come to the result?
Well, in the case of Coca-Cola, you know, my brain was going a mile a minute. Because I was doing commercials to make money. I worked as an artist, and I had a lot of freedom, but my goal was to do my first album. So Seven Waves, I couldn't find a record deal. No record company wanted to finance. And in those days, there were no home studios, you know. You had to go rent a studio that cost thousands of dollars a day. And so I needed money. And when I was approached for Coca-Cola, I thought, how can I make the most money? And when they brought me in for the sound, it was in the middle of a song. And I thought to myself, well, if I make something that works just for this song, that's all they're going to use it for. And I thought, if I make something that could work any place they wanted to put it, then I would be on to something. So I decided to make a sound that didn't have a pitch center, that wasn't a melody. I mean, I could have put a little melody in the space. They didn't say, would you make the sound of a Coca-Cola bottle opening? They had no idea what they wanted. They had a blank space. And they said, can you do something in there? And my answer was always yes. Yes. Okay. And then I'm thinking of bubbles, because this is something you can make electronically. You take a very low frequency waveform, put it into a filter, a bandpass filter, and then you filter up the harmonic series. And it's, you do a little magic on it, and it sounds like bubbles. And this worked in every jingle. Mm-hmm. And they used it. And I made my album. Yeah.
So maybe we can jump to like nature, because nature seems like a bit like you are a romanticist, like as you self called you. Like how influenced are you like by the sounds of nature? You're trying to, because you are reproducing them in a way with the synthesizer, like wind or the ocean or I don't know, birds. And is there a natural kinship maybe between the sounds of the Buchla and nature in a way? Like, and if so, why? Like, or what would that be?
There are a lot of connections with, you know, some people think of these machines as machines. They make noise, you know, they're... But for me, it was an instrument that was on all the time. It's electronic. I could program it, have it start to use randomness to generate ever-changing patterns, and it became part of the room. I could walk into my space, and here I've always played in quadraphonic, so it was immersive, and I could walk into the room and walk into the sound, and I could tweak it and change it. Now I forgot what I was talking about.
It's a nature question.
Oh, nature. Okay. So, no, it's funny now because I live, finally, after so many years, by the ocean. And sometimes I can't tell whether I'm indoors or outdoors because I have the ocean going on the Buchla inside and the birds are singing outside and the ocean is, the waves are crashing. And so it is all very connected. But the other thing is that the Buchla, in particular, is very good at making waves. I didn't realize it at the time. It just seemed something that was, you know, you could do, and you did. And now, in this iteration, in this generation, of new electronic gear, it's very hard to make waves. The filters don't have the same, you know, plunging. You can't go negative and come up. The bandpass filters, even the Buchla 200E, can't make waves. So, you know, there were a lot of things we had in the early designs. It's not like things got better. That's the myth of technology. They want to sell you more, so it's getting faster, better, you know, get more. And anyway, the waves. Nature is very important to me also. You know, then I moved from New York City in 1992 to the West Coast. I didn't know I was moving. I just went there and never went back. You know, we're all very outdoorsy there, and we're lucky. You know, I mean, nature, it's really every place, but it's nice to have fresh air and birds. And remember the pandemic when it started, and suddenly the birds started to sing again? It's wonderful.
And I mean, like, what kind of is close to this idea of nature in sound, somehow, at least I would say so, is this term New Age. I mean, like, you won, or you were nominated for the Grammy for these New Age albums. And I'm wondering if you could, like, really identify with this framing, or if it was something that you would rather, you know, like, circumvent or...
New Age to me was a place in the record store. So I had already released two albums, and there was no place for them in the store. They would put me in, you know, female vocalist, because they assumed that if, you know, I was a woman on the cover, I must be singing. Then there was just no place for it. And only when New Age came along, which was my third album, I was grateful, because now there was a category for instrumental music that was whatever you thought it was, neoclassical, spa music. I mean, it was never an agreed upon, nobody liked the category. But it worked, because people could go to the store and find the album. That's what it was.
So maybe also, it's also kind of touching upon nature, but this idea of the Buchla being an organism, like you said, something like it has a voice, it is a brain, like talking about life of machines. I'm wondering how this dialogue with the machine that you have, because it's a kind of feedback circuit, no? It kind of reacts to what you're doing, and then you react again, and then, like, a live show is kind of a dialogue, I can imagine. So could you maybe talk a bit about this communication?
It's a very organic being. You know, it is able to think. It's able to create, but I give it the parameters. So one of the parameters I love is randomness. The machine does that. I'm not sitting there plugging in, you know, live variables and numbers, you know, for pitches. No, I tell the machine, I want you to choose certain octaves randomly. And this is what keeps the machine alive. So machines like to repeat. And if you have a sequence, it just keeps going and going and going. And how can you introduce magic and variety in that? You do it with randomness. I use randomness, you know, in my performance tonight. Randomness is every place, but one place is the wave shape. So it's rhythmic, but it's not predictable. So it's interesting. If you were sitting there just listening to two notes, you know, repeating, you'd go crazy. But if those two notes that repeat are popping out in different timbres unpredictably, it's interesting. In another place, it's popping octave positions. So there's a, you know, a sequence that's going along like this, and all of a sudden I say randomly, choose a different octave, and suddenly you're hearing a melody up here, but it's not repeating. So there are all these processes that you can discover. I call them techniques. You know, there were techniques associated with all instruments. You know, on the piano you had arpeggios, or you had, you know, there were things that were pianistic, things that were violinistic, and I do things that are bouclistic.
So, but it, was it like special for the boucle to have this randomizer button, or how I imagine?
Yes.
Yeah.
Boucle was just an evil genius. He, you know, we were not. I went to work for him, you know, right after graduate school, and I don't think we ever exchanged two words. I mean, the first word he said to me was, "You're fired." And I just didn't leave. And he was so recessive, he just didn't know how to deal with it. And so I stayed, you know. But it's taken me a lifetime to really appreciate the genius of this individual. I call him the Leonardo da Vinci of electronic music instrument, modular electronic music instrument design. He would not allow the word synthesizer, for good reason. It's convenient, it's shorthand, but it's wrong, yeah. So, he discovered right away that spatial movement, you know, these sounds were monophonic, but they had no place of origin. It wasn't like you were supposed to hear it from the middle of the stage where the instrumentalist sat. No, it came out and it had no place, you know, so it could go any place with the same voltages that you're using to control all the parameters. So instead of using a keyboard to control the pitch or the volume, I mean, there was no volume control in the beginning. Anyway, you use voltages, and he was a genius at designing voltages. You know, the variety that you could get, and the spatial sound. I mean, he just, but the, you know, for all that I loved in the 200, which is what I played in the late 60s and the 70s, when I came back, 9 years ago, after a 40-year, pretty much, break, I had the 200E. And this was not, you know, it's been a process, because there were a lot of things I couldn't do that I used to be able to do. I knew it was supposed to get better, but it didn't get better. And so it's been a long process. I've had to make clones of some of the early modules. The filter, in particular, I mean, I couldn't make waves with the 200E. So now I have a clone of the early filter. I have a clone of the multiple arbitrary function generator, that thing on the upper left that you'll see if you come to the concert, and other things, yeah.
And this, like, this spatial dynamics that it's so important for your work, this quadraphonic setup, is because, like, this, like, Buchla used it that way, and because you knew that then that electronic sound, like you said before, or did it have any other, like, dimensions that I'm not, like, why is this spatial, like, the speciality, like, so important for your sound production?
It's alive. The sound wants to move, and it can move musically. So it's not just, you know, it's movement that's integrated into the whole compositional process. If you I can take a sustained sound and move it, and it becomes rhythmic. So motion is rhythm. And if they're not synchronized, it's a cacophony. This is the problem with some of the new so-called spatial systems. They're about placement, putting a sound, you know, because they came really from the film world. And you could place a sound here, place a sound here. And that's not what I'm doing. It's moving the sound in different ways. You know, there is, how can you move sound? You can move it continuously. You can move it distinctly, you know, rhythmically. You can move it randomly, so it jumps around. And so it's just part of the expression of the music, how you move it.
So we have 20 minutes to go. I would open it up to the audience and ask if someone has any questions yet. Yes, please. Mike is coming.
Hello. You've said that the electronic musical instruments didn't get better. What would you like to see in like contemporary electronic music instruments design? And what are the merits you judge an instrument on?
I can't say that I'm completely in touch with Eurorack. And I do marvel at, you know, just the sheer volume of modules that are coming out. And I do, for instance, pay attention to Make Noise. And I see a lot of beautiful, you know, design elements coming out. So it's not like I'm negative, but there are certain things that I would like to see. One is an elegant way to do quadraphonic. I think that it's the nature of electronic sound to want to move. It should be moving. So that's just natural. And you know, we're ready for it. You know, everybody's into immersive this and that. And, you know, the speaker companies are excited about multi-speaker. So that's one thing. Another thing is, I wish that people would just look, you know, at, you know, I'm a proselytizer for Buchla design, because I don't find, even the Buchla company today isn't doing some of the designs that I wish they would do. And one is the multiple arbitrary function generator. Now, this is strange, because Buchla himself thought it was a failed module. But this is the part of the secret of this whole thing is that a designer makes a tool, but you don't know what that tool is good for until you put it in the hands of the person who's going to use the tool. And they come at it with a completely different mindset. And it's that kind of chemistry that is really important in this instrument design world. You know, it's a conversation between the user. The designer can't possibly use the instrument in the same way that the pure user uses it, because they come to it with a muddled mind, you know. The inside, Buchla taught me, you know, there's the inside and there's the outside. And he would say, your job is to do the outside. And you tell me, you know, where do you want this? What do you want? And I'll do the inside. So, you know, it's an exciting field of design. And there are things like the filters. I mean, they're getting better. The sequencers. You know, there are some wonderful things in sequencing now, even in Make Noise. I mean, I'm, as I say, I'm not an authority on your rack. The basic thing that I was disappointed about was the size. So the Buchla, you know, he thought. He looked at the human hand. He was making an interface. You know, how is the human interacting with this? He had a feedback system, all these lights. When Eurorack started, I mean, there were no lights. How do you know what's going on inside the machine unless it talks back to you? And also, you know, that to get inside, I mean, I've got small hands, but I don't know how guys play those tiny little modules. Tell me, how do they know? So those are things, but I don't think the size is going to change, unless I'm wrong. Maybe we'll all get smaller hands. They'll do that, you know, with genetic. What is that called? Yeah.
We don't want to know.
Okay.
There's another question.
Yeah.
Yeah, thanks for your talk. I'm actually just starting to study sound design. And my question, because what I'm really interested in is like experimenting around within small devices, because I find it sometimes just great to see how much content and great stuff you can put out there with small devices. And I've been like wondering, I know this is quite generic, but what are some small devices that you like to use within your productions?
Oh boy, you've unmasked my... So I was working with an engineer from Moog. I'm trying to justify this, you know. And he said, oh, you know, maybe you'd like to see our, you know, our new toy here. It was the Animoog. And he showed me this thing on the iPad. And, you know, with any instrument, it takes a while. You don't get to know it right away. It's a process, right? Well, now the Animoog is like, I just can't get enough of it. You know, I love it. And it complements the Buchla a lot. And it's, do you know that app, the Animoog? Oh my God, you have to try it. It's so playable. And, you know, and it's got this, I can't even tell you what it all means, but there's a word for it. But anyway, the sound is very alive and there's a lot of control on the keyboard. And you can actually perform it. I'm into performance. So for me, an instrument has to be, this is another thing about what I'd like to see, is performability. And if you design an instrument under the umbrella of performability, it's a completely different approach from making an instrument that you don't care if it's live. You know, you get a menu and you've got to set things up and you've got to look for things, and that doesn't work. Yeah.
Are there any other questions? If you say like performability, like I was wondering, because Buchla was so against the clavier, what is it?
Keyboard,
right. What you as a, also like being trained as a piano player and stuff, like how you perceive that, like this negation of, yeah.
So Buchla put the fear of God in me. I was a pianist, classical pianist, and I get to his factory, I'm working there, and he gives us, you know, the keyboard is an inappropriate interface. It has ruined the understanding. You know, Switched on Bach came in and everybody thought that it was about sound. You know, the timbre. The timbre, no. It was about how you control sound with voltages. So from that moment, I couldn't be seen with a keyboard. And even today, there's a little switch in my head. And since I've come back to the Buchla, I have not played the piano. I just can't do both. There's a disconnect that was implanted, you know, in those early days. I yell at Wendy Carlos. She hates me because I say, you ruined it. It's not going on. The rock and roll guys, Keith Emerson, you know, all these guys that came in and, you know, hammered on the keyboard. And there's nothing wrong with that. But you're missing the whole other universe of compositional sound. And it's not about programming. You know, people say, yeah, because I used to do, you know, the DX7 sounds and all that. And that's, you know, it's fun. But it's just about developing a relationship with the machine and working with it. That's how we started. I know I'm just sounding like I only have one way to do things, but, in the early days, that's how you learned. There were no manuals. There were no classes. You just went and you worked with the machine, and that's the approach that I think is great. And if you don't have a machine that talks back to you and lets you work with it intuitively, get a Buchla.
Are there any other questions? So I'm like, it just came to my mind, this like Kraftwerk, like you, this man-machine or human-machine relation that they also build upon, like, and made their kind of thing. I mean, were you aware of them, and how did you feel like this relation with the machine is like, kind of, did you ever felt like a futuristic cyborg, whatever? Like, I don't know, but
Well, I looked at these phenomena as the possibilities of getting a record deal. So I was in the United States. I saw that electronic music had a following in Germany, mm-hmm. and also in Japan. So I went to Germany. But my music is not pop. It just is not. And I'm not a, you know, pumping iron rock and roller. Which I love. I mean, I love all music. I don't have a closed door to any kind of music. But I was in a different world. And so I got my first record deal in Japan because they had Tomita. And the companies there were open. As it turns out, I found out later, I could have gotten a deal in Germany, but I was so exhausted. You know, there was one more country to go to, or I forget the name of the label, and I just gave up. Then I found out that they were hoping I would come. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, there are all those stories. But anyway, it all worked out in Japan.
So we still have a few minutes. Maybe we can, because you realize created the installation soundtrack to our kind of elevator, like the Schlossberg elevator. And I was wondering, it's not that long or something, but as you said, it's not about length. So what was the idea behind that? Maybe we can.
That piece is actually an historic piece. It's a Buchla from the early days. It's like from the 60s. And why did I use that piece? Because I think the idea of somebody thinking that I was going to design something that went up and down, I listened to this piece and I thought, this is perfect because it's the machine singing. It's a relative of this elevator. This elevator is a machine that is creating, you know, a composition. And so maybe somebody could, you know, unmask this themselves, I don't know. But I didn't know I was supposed to do something like new. So I just heard it and it seemed right to me, because it's in the same family as the machine. And as I said, I could do things back then that I can't do now with the machine. So I wanted it to have its place for those short moments when you're suspended in time and space to hear the early Buchla.
So you have a like huge sound collection, possibly. How do you order that? Like I'm just thinking, like, how is there any kind of like chronologically or after, I don't know, features that the sounds have, or how do you?
No, I'm not that organized. but how it all started was when Finders Keepers approached me to release unreleased. You know, for me, recording, you know, I spent $200,000 in 2 years on my Seven Waves album. You know, I had to use the highest technology, the most expensive this, and I was in New York. And to release things that were done in my garage in Berkeley, I wasn't going to do that. And we had lots of, you know, it took them a couple of years to get through to me because I couldn't understand why they would want to do this. And on the other hand, I realized that these tapes were deteriorating and that if I didn't transfer them, they would be gone. Because after 30 years, 35 years, they just don't last. And so that was my selfish reason. I started a project of digital transfers and archiving of early tapes. And, you know, I would just send them to Andy, and he would pick things and release it. For me to release a Buchla concert album that was recorded on a cassette, you know, it's like, I my brain couldn't deal with that. I mean, it is a document. It was an original quadraphonic performance that is now, we have this little tiny, you know, thread of what it was. But for me, even, I'm grateful to have that document.
I think we're grateful too.
Oh, good. Okay.
So, if there is no other question.
There's a question.
Oh, there is a question. Thanks.
You're so brave.
I'm trying to word this in a way that is understandable, but I'm interested in your relationship with the machine in a way. And I was wondering if you see the machine that you're operating, which is the Buchla in that case, if you see that more as an extension of your brain in a way that allows you to express your artistic thoughts, or if it's more of a self-sustained thing that speaks for itself and that you control. Does that make any sense?
Well, it is a partnership, and I do control it, yeah. I mean, I think of it, you know, I certainly couldn't fly an airplane, but I want you to know that you're in safe hands in the concert, you know. There's a lot of conjecture about electronic music that is this constantly surprising, you know, unpredictable thing. I love when that happens. You know, there's always room for that. I mean, something doesn't work, something's not patched right, something, you know, all of those upsets are openings for doing something. I love when it gets unpredictable. But other than that, you know, my job up there, how romantic. And, you know, I shouldn't talk about it like that, but really, what it is for me is this very intense moment in the present.
It's like walking on a tightrope. It's at risk, or you wouldn't be alive. You know, the beauty of it is that there is risk, and there is unpredictability. You don't know what, completely what you're going to do. I mean, I certainly had, you know, a structure, but I'm alive in the moment doing that. So in the early days, I was actually in love with the machine, and I thought there was something wrong with me. And so I went to this consciousness-raising weekend, and at the end of the weekend, their revelation was that humans are machines. And if we only understood their operating systems better, we'd get along better. And I thought, oh, okay, nothing wrong with me. I'm in love with the machine and I'm still getting to know it. You know, it would be boring, just the way people would be boring if they were completely predictable. Did that answer your question? Yeah, okay, yeah.
So,
8 seconds left, seven seconds, 5 seconds.
I'm also kind of, we're all happy to see you perform live tonight. 10:30, Dom in Berg, don't miss it. And I say thank you, thanks so much for this conversation.
Thank you very much. Thank you. It was lovely, thank you. Thank you.